Dublin. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublin. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Max Levine?
Hello, yes, this is he.
Hello, Max. This is Paul Holdengraber, calling you from the Quarantine Tapes, presented, or I should say co-presented, by Onassis, LA and Dublab. I'm so happy you could take the time to speak to us. Tell me, Max, where do I find you, and how have you been spending these last 12, 13, nearly 14 months of this delirious period we're in the middle of?
Well, thank you, Paul. It's wonderful to hear from you. As we sit here today, I'm at my office in Echo Park in Los Angeles, and I've been spending most of the last 13 months coming to the office and in Los Angeles and spending time with my family and with my team and others here, just, you know, getting through it and trying to make the best of a challenging year for everybody.
So tell me a little bit, if you could, when you say go to the office, what happens in that office? You might tell our listeners a little bit about who is Max Levine, and in a way, my question is, who is Max Levine and who was Max Levine?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there. So thanks for the question. I run a company called NICO, which stands for the Neighborhood Investment Company. And it's a real estate investment company, and we're trying to create a new model that really distributes the benefits of property ownership and local investment, you know, much more equitably to lots of people within a community. And I guess I got there to this position in NICO, starting in, you know, the real estate investment business close to 20 years ago, and have been, you know, on a path towards creating, you know, this new model, really since then. I was born in New York City and grew up there in the 80s. And I think, you know, having lived through, you know, a tremendous amount of change, lived through and observed a tremendous amount of change, you know, in New York over the last 40 or so years, it really sort of has informed my thinking around NICO and around neighborhoods and how to, you know, sort of push back on some of the conventions that have, you know, shaped neighborhoods in this last couple of cycles.
As I was preparing to speak to you, I was reminded that actually today is the birthday of Jane Jacobs. Born in 1916, is there something in her that sparked an interest in what you do now?
Well, I mean, Jane Jacobs is, you know, one of the icons of the last century and certain in the world of urbanism. You know, I think that sort of pushback against large scale, top down, you know, the kind of Robert Moses and the idea of the genius master planner, you know, who is a all powerful, all knowing solver of problems. I think that as a critique of that approach, and instead focusing on, you know, the scale of the streets and the relationship between, you know, these weird creatures that we call neighbors, right, who we live in these cities with, I think that you know, that reframing of how to, you know, understand kind of the urban conditions is, you know, I think it sort of permeates all areas of thinking around cities, if you want to pay attention to that.
And it's been interesting recently to read tributes to Jane Jacobs and people thinking, what would cities look like if they were more often built by women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure I'm in a position to speculate on that.
Neither am I. But I'm in a position to think about it.
Yeah. It's a fascinating, and I would say, you know, beyond thinking about it in terms of women, I mean, what would happen if cities were built kind of with the people who live there kind of at the center of the decision making, right? You know, because the sort of establishment and historical like mode of, you know, this problematic world, you know, word called placemaking, the place is made for or people or some set of interests, right? But rarely is a place, you know, made in a way that is truly reflecting the needs and desires of folks who, you know, have called that place home, you know, long before that intervention, right? So that idea is really sort of at the core of, you know, what I think some of the most interesting thinking around these challenges and opportunities, right, that are in neighborhoods and in cities really are, which is like this question of like, who is it for, right?
Right.
What is being done and who is it for and who is at the center of that decision? And really like even beyond the decision-making itself, like who is going to derive benefit or gain and who is going to be harmed or displaced or otherwise negatively impacted by, you know, said intervention.
Well, you know, when I brought up Jane Jacobs, I brought her up obviously for a good reason, because I imagined that somehow her impact would have made you think differently, perhaps, about the ways in which you began and what you're doing now, and thinking about the death and life of great American cities. I was reminded when reading your Community Wealth Grants program, which I'd love you to explain to our listeners. You have this line in it, which I think is so interesting. You say, the way wealth is created in America needs to evolve to be more local, more inclusive, and more focused on balancing financial outcomes with human outcomes. And you end passage in your newsletter by saying, we hope this crisis ends soon. And you wrote that a year ago, and obviously the crisis, we're still in the midst of it.
Yeah. And the crisis, you know, I mean, I think it'll be 10 years before we truly start to understand what the impact of, you know, this last year and a half will be over time. I am optimistic that the sort of immediate health crisis that we've all been operating under is nearing a resolution. But, you know, as with anything that is as broad and, you know, it's hard to think of examples that have impacted so many at the same time, like at this scale, but it takes time for that, the impact of that sort of scale of thing to work through the system. But, you know, one thing that sort of gets to that question is like this idea of financial outcomes and non-financial outcomes. The interesting thing is, you know, when you talk to people about investing, there's a lot of people have like a tough reaction even to that idea of investing, right? And there's a lot of guilt built up around it. And there's a lot of shame around people feeling like, you know, they haven't done what they thought they should do or what sort of society expects of them. And, you know, one of the areas where that is, you know, getting worse and worse is really like around this idea of homeownership and this idea around sort of the societal expectation that everyone should aspire to be a homeowner, right? And that's sort of the inevitable, you know, goal that everybody should want for themselves. You know, this is a country, and especially when we talk about, you know, cities like Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco and, you know, some of the more expensive cities, you know, these are places where, you know, the idea of homeownership, traditional homeownership, you know, is really, you know, that's not a realistic goal for so many people. So the question is, you know, how do we create alternatives to that are not sort of second fiddle, right, to the idea that you should be a homeowner, right? And how do we elevate renters and elevate other forms of, you know, tenure in a way that, you know, sort of create similar wealth building opportunities? You know, the idea in the past that, you know, you would buy a home and put down roots and, you know, that was sort of, you know, within reach for middle-class people. I mean, that's just not the case anymore. And the idea of home, right, which like in America is this super complicated thing because it's both, you know, for most people, it's both, whether you're a renter or a homeowner, it's like the largest financial, you know, commitment or decision, right, that most people make in their lives is that, you know, monthly mortgage payment or that monthly rent payment. And so it's this big financial thing. It's held up as this wealth building thing if you're able to be a homeowner. But it's also, you know, I mean, it's your home. It's fulfilling this basic essential, you know, need for shelter and belonging and security. And somewhere in the middle of those things, sort of trying to reconcile the human needs of being in a home and the shelter with the financial expectations of, you know, the American dream and it's out of reach and all this stuff. It's really complicated for folks. And sort of in like working on that issue and that problem through NECO, which is a solution that, you know, we're trying to sort of put in the middle of traditional homeownership and renting, right? So something that is allows people to become shareholders in a community benefit corporation that owns real estate in a neighborhood. And in, you know, having a share structure allows people to invest, not once you save enough for a down payment, but it allows you to invest, you know, really starting at $95, wanting to meet people where they are and give people an opportunity, you know, through this model to build wealth, invest in their community, invest locally, and to do so in a fair, flexible, you know, an incremental way.
Max, briefly, yeah. How does it work? Because the model, in a way, using the deep issue of home, which is both financial and emotional, you're in a way trying to change the way we find a home and we're able to, as it were, afford a home.
Yeah. So the way the model works, you know, in a nutshell, is that there's a company that's called a Neighborhood Real Estate Investment Trust, or a Neighborhood REIT. We've launched the first Neighborhood REIT here in Echo Park. It's called NECO Echo Park Benefit Corporation. And the company owns a portfolio of rent-stabilized multifamily housing properties in Echo Park. And through a public offering, we are able to, and through our website, we're able to offer investment in that company starting at $95. And so the idea there is that we're really inspired by the Green Bay Packers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with how the Green Bay Packers are owned, but it's the only major professional sports team in North America to be actually owned by the community that it's in. And our idea with NECO is, what would happen if everybody within a neighborhood was able to become a financial stakeholder in that community? And so the structure and the model is really geared towards trying to create a way for everybody within a community to be a part of the wealth creation and also the sort of agency and decision-making power that comes with being an owner. And I think that idea of being an owner, you know, should not just be for the wealthy, it should be for everybody. And the idea that a neighborhood real estate investment trust or a neighborhood REIT, you know, could be a structure that actually starts to take some of the issues around gentrification, around sort of the alignment of how investment capital comes into communities, and instead basically includes the community as principal financial stakeholders in that. That's really sort of the future that we're trying to build through this model.
And, you know, in reading about your company, so fascinating, I was also interested by the language you use. You don't talk about yourself as a landlord, but as a housing provider. And landlord, of course, has a very interesting background. You can really trace it back all the way back to the Middle Ages, to a feudal system that, in a way, the lord of the land. I mean, we don't often hear it. And then we speak about landlord, and then, of course, we speak in a different way about something perhaps connected to it, but not necessarily, which is slumlord. And that, because my mind is fairly digressive, as you may have noticed, made me think of an extraordinary poem by Langston Hughes called The Ballad of the Landlord, written in 1940, and I'll quote just a little bit from it. It begins with, "Landlord, landlord, my roof has sprung a leak. Don't you remember I told you about it? I told about it way last week. Landlord, landlord, these steps is broken down. When you come up yourself, it's a wonder you don't fall down. $10, you say, I owe you. $10, you say, is due. Well, that $10 is more than I'll pay you till you fix this house up new." And it ends with this tenant, which is another very interesting word, which means to be held to, actually being put in jail. And I'm wondering, you know, how conscious you are of the language you use when you use a word like housing provider instead of landlord, and what that might mean to you.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating poem. And it really sums up the power dynamic that I think we all feel as renters. I mean, I'm a renter as well. And so I'll start by saying, like, we're very careful about the language because words are really important. And because, you know, a word like landlord, it does come from a relationship that is, you know, at the very least based on a class structure, right? You know, the landed gentry, the lords who were given land by the crown, and then renting it out to tenants, you know, to put it to productive use. I mean, that comes from a rigid class system. And there's such a power, you know, built into that language that really carries through, right? And so, you know, for example, like I've spent an unbelievable amount of time thinking about that relationship. And one of the things I should say about Nico and about what we're trying to build is that, you know, we've organized the first neighborhood REIT, but we're also the first housing REIT to be organized as something called a benefit corporation, which means that we have basically a legal responsibility and objective to, you know, not to maximize financial value, but to balance financial returns with the social and environmental impact of our business on stakeholders, which include, you know, lots of different people, not just our shareholders. And I would say a big part of the reason to organize the company in that way is because that, you know, quote unquote, landlord-tenant relationship is one that is so loaded with exploitation and with a power dynamic and with really, you know, what a colleague of mine on a panel recently called sort of, you know, institutionalized abuse, right, as a business strategy. And so, you know, I am a housing provider. I run a company that is a housing provider. I've thought so much about this. I'm also a renter. And I'll say, you know, the people who own the house that I rent are lovely people, very responsible. And there's still that power dynamic where, you know, I don't like how it feels, right?
Right.
So that's always right there when we talk about those words. And I think part of the challenge, you know, and part of the mission to elevate sort of rental type of models and what are called sort of shared equity models like Nico to be a new alternative to traditional homeownership really has to do with resetting the trust and the respect and the power dynamic of that relationship that's implied by the words landlord and tenant. And so, yeah, we don't use those words, and that's very intentional and very supportive to, you know, trying to create something that is in this new direction.
And you know, the words are so important. We think of the word we've been using for the last year, more than a year. You know, the word lockdown, which really, really comes from prison language. The same way deadline comes from prison language. You know, it's a line whereby which if you're in a prison and you trespass that line, you can be shot. So it's incredibly important. The very words we use, and as I understand it, you took measures during this shutdown when people who were part of Nico, whatever that might exactly mean, they could rely on you not to be evicted, and you applied their security deposits to their rent, if I understood this correctly, and you also provided assistance, direct cash assistance in the amount of $150,000, which in your materials say doesn't need to be repaid. So I'm wondering if this is all true, it nearly feels too true to be good. And are you running a philanthropy, or are you running something that actually wants to make a benefit?
Yeah, unbelievable. Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, you know, so in the early days of the pandemic, you know, thinking back to, you know, March 2020, we basically launched as a public company on March 27, 2020. And, you know, I think the emergency order or the lockdown, as it, you know, was called, again, with respect to the meaning of that word, you know, I think was March 19th. So just about a week or so before. And, you know, it was a little bit like, you know, as a benefit corporation, you know, the way that we measure success is different. And so the answer is no, we're not running a philanthropy. This is a for-profit business.
Yes.
But how we define success is different than a company whose job it is to, quote unquote, maximize shareholder value. It's a new type of investing. It's called triple bottom line investing, or sometimes called stakeholder capitalism. But basically what it means is, what it means to me, my understanding of it, is that the things that should be internalized in all business, which is what are the outcomes that you're generating for people who are impacted by your company's activities, all that it means is that you take on a responsibility for those outcomes. And so in how we measure success, one of our focus areas and one of our priorities as a company is to help preserve neighborhood diversity and stability. So when you're a benefit corporation, you have to define what you're going for, basically, how you're going to track your non-financial, you know, the financial progress is easy, this accounting and audits and all that stuff for that. The non-financial progress, you have to define and then report on, you know, how you're doing against those areas that you've defined. And one of the areas that we've defined is neighborhood stability and diversity. And so for us, launching that rent assistance program, which totaled about up to about $350,000 of total assistance to our residents and commercial tenants, was actually very in line with our objectives as a for-profit company, which was to help enhance the diversity and stability of our community. And we're really proud of that program. The way that the program worked was residents or commercial tenants had to do a survey and interview with a member of our team. They had to have a self-defined hardship because of COVID. And once they opted into that, we released first their security deposit, that which is really their money that we're holding on their behalf. So they had to use that money first towards back rent. And then once that was used up, then they were eligible to tap into a rent assistance grant fund, which NECO, the sponsor company, just made as a cash grant. And then the third part, which we're just now, you know, sort of rolling out, is that we have offered to each of our residents and commercial tenants up to $1,000 in shares of the neighborhood REIT towards the longer term objective of having as many of them as possible, you know, participate in this model and be part of showing the world what can happen when, you know, neighbors invest and own together.
And so the objective here of this assistance is what? Is it to ward against, as it were, eviction?
Yeah. So there's a couple of levels that I could answer that at. I think to at the first level, we wanted to make sure that, you know, in this incredibly stressful time, and at the time we thought, you know, our sort of working idea was like this would be a 6-month thing, right? So here we are 13 months later,
you and everyone,
or more,
you and everyone,
right?
Else.
And so, you know, we didn't plan for this, Paul, but you know, we put this program in place right away. It was the security deposit piece was in place in time for April 1 rent, so for the next rent cycle. So we acted very early on this. And the first objective, just on the surface, was this is pretty stressful for everybody. We don't want our community of residents and commercial tenants to be worried about rent when they're out of work. That was number one. Number two is, you know, in the city of Los Angeles, there's a pretty broad set of protections for renters that were put in place pretty early, which, you know, I'm grateful for. Most of the multifamily apartment buildings, rental buildings in the city of Los Angeles are in a program called the Rent Stabilization Ordinance, or the RSO program anyway. And so those buildings and all of our buildings are what are called rent stabilized or RSO buildings. As a result of these protections that are in place, what you have in these buildings is a very socioeconomically diverse group of residents, right? And so you have some residents who are, you know, sort of moving in and out more regularly. And then you have a group of residents that, you know, varies in our portfolio. It's, I think, close to 40% have been in the buildings for 5 years or more. And I think 18% or so have been there for 10 years or more. But it varies depending on the building. And the people who've been there the longest because of this rent protected status typically pay way below the current market rent per unit. So if you are a capital L landlord, right, to use that word that we're talking about before, you actually have a profit motive for the folks who have been there the longest and are paying below market rent to owe you as much money as possible and, you know, potentially leave, right, at the end of this to so that you can make more rent and have a better financial return. And so for us, it was a very important moment, you know, in this pandemic to do everything within our power to make sure that that did not happen for any one of our residents, and to instead prioritize the stability and security, especially of our long-term residents. The program applied equally to everybody, but, you know, it was a moment where in putting this program out, the intention was very much to draw a line in the sand and say, this is a different way to do this. And, you know, I actually believe that neighborhoods and buildings and communities that are socioeconomically diverse, where every attempt is made to preserve and enhance that socioeconomic diversity, I believe that those are more interesting neighborhoods, better neighborhoods, stronger neighborhoods, stronger communities. And I would rather be a housing provider and own and manage buildings in those types of neighborhoods than in neighborhoods where that has been eliminated through displacement and profit maximization.
Max, I have so many more questions. They will be for another time. I wanted to talk to you precisely about homelessness and also evictions. And in one way, one question that I keep coming up again and again and again in my mind is, if you are a landlord, as it were, using that word with everything we've said before, and that is, and you're a retiree, let's say, and that's your only source of income, what are you to do that would be ethically correct in this situation? But we will leave this for another time, Max. And I just want to tell you, thank you so much. It was so inspiring to learn about Nico. And I hope our listeners, wherever they may be, they're in 147 countries, but wherever they may be, we will put in the notes information about Nico so they can find out and maybe create themselves communities that are led by what one might call, in the best sense of the word, the utopian kind of fervor you bring to what you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was a pleasure. Pleasure speaking to you, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.